On our first matter, docket number 83847, parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your
Honor. Okay. As you know, Justice Lee was recused off of this, so we have the Chief Justice sitting in her place. Thank you again, Chief. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thank you, Justice.
Okay. Due to her obligations administratively, later this morning and this afternoon, she can't travel to Las Vegas today, so she's joining us remotely from Carson City. Mr. Breeden, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. And you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Justice Herndon, and may it please the court. It's often said that the rule of the Supreme Court is not as much focused on error correction as it is to announce new law on previously undecided issues and to clarify the law on issues not resolved by prior cases. To that end, I'd like to focus my oral argument today on two issues that I think have statewide importance to perhaps hundreds, if not thousands, of injury cases. The first is the use of informed consent in a medical malpractice trial as a defense. And there has never been a reported Nevada Supreme Court decision on this topic. The second is the level of proof or the burden of production that is imposed on a personal injury claimant to establish the usual, customary, and reasonable amounts of their medical bills. Not the reasonableness and necessity of the treatment, but the amount of the bill as damages. And this issue has not been clearly addressed by the Nevada Supreme Court in over 80 years since the Curdy case. And I think our case law is in need of some updating to give the district courts guidance based on modern medical practice. I'll start with the informed consent issue as a defense, or rather a faux defense, in a medical malpractice action. And when I say informed consent defense, what I'm referring to is evidence or arguments to the effect that the patient went for a procedure. Prior to the procedure, the patient was told there were certain risks or complications that are possible to the procedure, that the patient was informed of those risks and accepted those risks or chose to proceed regardless. When you talk about the use of this as a faux defense in medical malpractice cases, it is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Almost never will you find that the defense uses the actual phrase assumption of risk directly. It will come in terms, as it did in this case, where you have repeated questions of the patient, plaintiff, the experts, and comments in closing argument to the effect that, look, all procedures have risks. These were known risks. The patient knew about these. She knows risks are possible. And yet she consented to the surgery anyway. And that's exactly the type of evidence and arguments that were used in this particular case.
Would you say that the idea of risks and complications, and I draw a distinction between that and informed consent, but that the idea of risks and complications can have some, can have some relevance in a medical malpractice case?
So I believe we need to rephrase that question and acknowledge that it is a defense if a unavoidable risk occurred. An example, an allergic reaction might be an unavoidable risk. We know when there are organ transplants that for some reason the procedure can be perfectly done and yet the body will reject the organ. That is an unavoidable risk. In this case, you had a doctor using a medical instrument who either burnt or pushed that instrument through two different organs in the patient's body, causing severe injury. That is simply not the type of unavoidable risk outside the control of the physician that the physician cannot help. And that is the distinction here, and something that I think needs to be stressed in the decision that comes out of this case. We can talk about risks, but only in the sense if they are truly unavoidable risks. And as I tried to stress in our reply brief, I made certain that all of the medical experts testified, look, this was not an unavoidable risk. This procedure could have been safely performed on this patient. And although even the reply brief tries to again argue that this occurred because of the patient's abnormal uterine anatomy, this was none of the experts testified that the anatomy caused this. And you're never going to do this procedure on someone with normal anatomy. It's always done on somebody who has a medical issue. And all of the experts testified that they believe this procedure could be safely performed. What we had here was a case where the doctor below the standard of care was cutting and using the thermal part of the instrument without clear visualization of what he was cutting. And that's why he went all the way through the uterus and into the small bowel when neither one of those organs is intended to be breached. When we talk about that this is a improper faux defense or argument in a medical malpractice case, we have to remember that many states have already considered this issue and determined that that is reversible error by itself to make these sorts of evidence and arguments. I will note that very strangely in this case, the district court recognized that that was a correct statement of the law. The district court then reversed itself and said, well, I'll exclude the informed consent form itself, but I will continue to allow the argument and testimony on this issue. And then during trial, a discharge paper that appeared to be just like an informed consent form was considered and allowed. So the defense got their piece of paper that they could put in front of the jury to say, look, these are risks of the procedure. This was given to the patient. The patient knew about it and consented. And everything about that type of argument is improper and has been repeatedly held to be improper in other states. The reasons, quickly before I move on, the policy reasons why we don't allow that is, first of all, the patient cannot consent to negligence by the physician. The physician owes the patient a skillfully performed procedure, regardless of the risks. Known risks simply mean that this procedure has been performed before, and if the physician doesn't use adequate skill, certain events might occur. And lastly, if you leave this issue of risk up to the medical community to determine, they have an unfortunate history that they simply call everything a risk in order to get out of liability in malpractice cases. And just anecdotally, I can tell you, I recently saw a consent form for a tooth extraction that said one of the risks is death. I mean, if you leave these issues to the medical community, they've simply tried to self-deem everything a risk and claim that that is a defense. And that's what the opinion from this case needs to address and refute. I'd like to move on.
Let me, and I apologize for interrupting, but let me ask you one more question. On the hypothetical you gave on something truly unforeseeable, that maybe there was a place for risk and complication evidence, how, in your opinion, would that evidence be appropriately presented to the jury? Lay testimony, documents, expert testimony? Because it seemed here that the risk and complication evidence came in all those different types of forms. Like your client was questioned about it, there were hospital forms, discharge instructions, there were experts that were questioned about it. And it would seem to me that, and I'm sure Ms. Hall will respond to this as well, that that's not something for the layperson or for a plaintiff, but that's something that should lie with an expert to talk about risk and complications.
Well, I do acknowledge it was all barrels at trial. They were allowed to use document evidence to question lay people, argue it in closing, and address it with experts. But the problem is, to even allow an expert to just come in and say, well, yes, there's a risk of perforation from this procedure, that really tells the jury nothing about the skill of the physician that needs to be used to satisfy the standard of care or the skill that was actually used by the physician in this procedure. As an example, in this case, one of the things the defense did was, in cross-examining Ms. Taylor's expert, they got him to admit that perforations are a risk of the procedure. Now, the expert further explained that the risk of perforation, and where he has personally caused these before, is during the blind portion of the procedure that you can't see with the camera when you're originally inserting the instrument. That's not when this particular perforation occurred. This perforation occurred when the instrument should have been under full visualization, and such a perforation should never happen to the uterus, let alone the small bowel way on the other side of the uterus that's flexible. You'd have to very directly burn it or hit it to cause this type of injury. But you see, that's how the term risk even is a bit deceptive. Just to merely say something is a risk does not tell the jury and give it enough context as to how this injury is avoidable or unavoidable by the physician. And I think that the case law really needs a shift in the terminology that's used to this concept of unavoidable risks versus avoidable risks, or things that are truly within the control of the physician. If I may move on, the next thing, and I'm not sure if my time remaining includes the 3 minutes for rebuttal or
it does not.
It does. So I have roughly a minute here, and I would just move on briefly because time for oral argument is limited to this issue of the burden of production and the burden of proof for a personal injury claimant when they are presenting medical bills as special damages. In this case, over $200,000 of medical bills were excluded on the basis that there was no evidence that these were usual, customary, and reasonable. We need to update our case law. We're past the days of Curdy, where you have the rural doctor who does all of his own billing and is familiar with his own billing practices and charge masters. Today, these are done by billing professionals. They're done off of charge masters or set schedules. It should be sufficient if the defense does not have any contrary evidence that the bill itself is prima facie evidence of the usual, reasonable, and customary amount charged. Certainly in this case, we had billing professionals. We had the CFO of one of the major hospital groups in Nevada appear and testify to that. And I see my time is up, so I'll.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Hall?
Good morning, Heather Hall for respondents. May it please the court. I'd like to start, Your Honors, with some of the initial points that were raised by Mr. Breeden. And the first thing I'd point out to the court is that all of the grievances which have been raised by appellant in this appeal do not rise to the level that would merit awarding a new trial, and that's because the jury verdict that was issued was supported by substantial evidence. And I'd like to start first with the assumption of the risk argument and the assertion that the defense presented at trial a theory that Ms. Taylor assumed the risk of negligence. First and foremost, I would point out I do believe there's a distinction between informed consent and risks and complications of a particular procedure. And as the court is aware, in the trial of this case, the district court specifically excluded the defense from either showing the informed consent forms to the jury. Those were not admitted into evidence, nor was the patient education material that is provided by Women's Health Associates and Dr. Brill before the surgery admitted to the jury. Those were specifically excluded, which is markedly different from the 2019 Busick versus Trainer case, the unpublished decision from this court. And the reason that the defense was permitted, however, to discuss the risks and complications and what the patient was specifically told in that regard is because it did have some relevance in this particular case. And I think what appellant is advocating for is a wholesale exclusion of both informed consent and discussion of risks and complications. And I think it would be more appropriate to allow the trial court to do a case-by-case analysis and determine under the specific facts whether it has any relevance. And that is
how does it have relevance here? I mean, because you know, what Mr. McBride said in closing on a variety of occasions was Ms. Taylor was counseled on her options. She was advised of the potential risks and benefits. She even acknowledged that on the stand. She was given options by Dr. Brill, including the risks and complications. She acknowledged receiving the risks and potential complications, including preparation. I mean, so how is it relevant? Where would we draw the line, and where has been too much focus on the patient's consent to a procedure such that it does beg the question of whether it was fair?
Sure, Your Honor, and I can address that. I think the relevance here, if you recall, there was, in addition to an allegation that the surgery itself was performed negligently and below the standard of care, plaintiff, as well as their expert, Dr. Burke, offered an opinion that the standard of care was violated in not disclosing to the patient that the uterine perforation had occurred. So the relevance is the fact that there was discussion of uterine perforation and injury to other organs being a potential complication before the surgery weighs in favor or has a tendency to make it more probable that he did in fact discuss that a uterine perforation had occurred once it did. And I think that's important because that was a standard of care violation that Counsel, was alleged and put forth by the plaintiff.
Counsel, Justice Stiglitz, I'm sorry, it's tough when I'm coming offline. I don't mean to interrupt you. How does that necessarily follow? The fact that there are the paperwork talking about potential risks, how is that relevant on whether he should have told her that it actually happened? So I'm not, you're saying like one necessarily follows. How does that inform that at all?
Well, and thank you, Chief Justice. I'm not saying that it's relevant as to whether he was required to tell her that a uterine perforation had occurred. I'm saying it's relevant to demonstrating to the jury that he did, in fact, have that discussion, because I think it was universally agreed that he was required by the standard of care to advise the patient of a perforation once one occurred and he was aware of it. So my point is, I think that the plaintiff in this trial went so far as to insinuate that not only did he not disclose it, he specifically hid it. And there was evidence presented by the plaintiff that the nursing note where it's noted complications none per surgeon, that somehow that was Dr. Brill attempting to hide this uterine perforation from the plaintiff. So I don't think it goes to whether the standard of care requires the discussion. I think it goes to whether the discussion happened after the surgery. And it was always the defense's position that Dr. Brill, although he doesn't recall the specifics of any conversation with her in the recovery room, it would be his custom and practice to have that conversation. The fact that that is a potential risk discussed with the patient before surgery even happens, it weighs in favor of there being a discussion of that occurring.
That wasn't argued at all, though. That there was nothing in Mr. McBride's closing argument that tried to tie the pre-surgical risk and complication discussing to somehow justify that he really told her about it in the post-surgical two-minute conversation he had with her. The only argument Mr. McBride made about that was Dr. Brill told you jurors that he would always have conversations with patients afterwards and talk to them about the surgery. And so it seems pretty obvious that he would have done that here, even though he doesn't remember it at this point.
And Your Honor, I do think that was argued by Mr. McBride. If you look at the totality of his closing argument, he made several statements about the fact that if Dr. Brill were trying to hide this uterine perforation that occurred, why would he note that in his operative report? Why would he discuss that as a potential risk with the patient before surgery even happens? So although there were more statements about known risks and complications than just that, there were statements in his closing argument that did tie that together. And with regard to the assumption of risk, the points that I wanted to make sure and make for the court, I think it is important here to note that at no time did we say that these perforations happened, and because the patient consented and was advised of these as a potential complication, don't find the physician negligent. To the contrary, what we argued is that these were perforations that happened in the absence of negligence, and that when you look at the avoidable versus unavoidable, what is very unique about this particular patient is she had two uterine abnormalities that all of the medical experts agreed are uncommon, especially in combination. She had both what's called a bicornuate uterus or heart-shaped uterus, so the shape of it was abnormal, and also the positioning of her uterus was abnormal in that it was retroverted and how it was positioned inside of the patient. So I think that does go to whether this was a complication that could have been avoided if only the physician had met the standard of care. And if you look at the testimony of the defense's retained expert, Dr. McCarris, and this is volume 11 of the appendix, and it starts at 2212 of that, Dr. McCarris was asked very specifically about whether a complication means that it's always that a physician didn't commit negligence because it was a complication. And he explained that there are times when you can do surgery and you do everything that is expected of you and you do it correctly and you can get a complication. There's times where surgery is not done correctly or not done appropriately and you can get a complication. And so he and I on his direct exam had a very detailed discussion in front of the jury about the fact that just because it was a known risk and complication doesn't mean there cannot be negligence. The reason it was not negligence here is because Dr. Brill performed the surgery correctly and with proper technique, and the risk of this complication was mitigated as best he could, but because of her abnormal anatomy, it was unavoidable. So that is the defense that was presented at trial. It was not that Ms. Taylor consented to negligence.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Breeden. Assuming there is a case where risk and complication evidence is relevant, how should that come in? And more pointedly, is it appropriate to be questioning the plaintiff about that or introducing hospital documentation like discharge instructions? Or is that something left more appropriately to an expert witness to talk about risk and complications?
I think it depends, Your Honor, on the specific circumstances and facts and evidence presented. Here, the reason that it was appropriate to ask Ms. Taylor those questions is because she was denying knowing that a uterine perforation had occurred, despite there being evidence from the EMTs who came to her home later that evening, where she specifically stated to the EMTs that there was an issue with the perforation. So that is why in this particular case, she was asked a few of those questions. I think it really depends on the case. There may be cases where it's more appropriate to leave that only to the retained experts, but here that was the aim of my cross-exam of Ms. Taylor, and I think that's what was elicited at trial. And keeping in mind the time, I'll try and move on a bit after I finish a couple points regarding assumption of risk. But the one thing I wanted to also point out is just like in, so the difference between this case and Busick is that in Busick, the consent form itself was actually admitted and presented to the jury. Here, as I've explained, that did not occur. The jury was not given consent forms. I think discharge instructions from the hospital are very different. That's about what the patient should do if she experiences anything. And that is the only thing that was admitted into evidence regarding this topic with regard to documents. The consent form was excluded. The educational materials were excluded. So in Busick, the consent form was admitted. But in Busick, just like here, there was a limiting jury instruction that was given to the jury and specifically told them that assumption of risk is never a defense to negligence. It was a very detailed jury instruction The only real market difference between the instruction given here and what was given in Busick is because there was absolutely no evidence of consent specifically presented to the jury, the words risk or complication were included because that's the evidence that the defense was allowed to present. And that instruction, that certainly, if the court feels that there was any undue emphasis on risks and complications, that limiting instruction mitigated any potential prejudice to the plaintiff in the trial. And regarding the medical bills issue, I would first point out that the jury never got to damages in this case. And so I do not believe that there is standing for the plaintiff to challenge whether the bills were excluded or admitted. But if the court feels differently, the standard is for abuse of discretion, and it was not an abuse of discretion for the trial court to exclude those medical bills. The reason that they were excluded is because there was no expert to comment on whether those bills were reasonable, necessary, and causally related.
So why should that necessitate an expert?
Because the amount of damages and whether there's a causal link between subsequent care and what you're saying is negligence requires expert testimony, I think, under Cook versus Sunrise Hospital as well.
That didn't seem to be what the court was saying. The court just seemed to be saying broadly, hey, you need an expert to come in that's kind of evaluated a community and say that these are reasonable and customary within a community. I agree with you that the damages have to be tied to the alleged negligence. But in terms of what was presented here, I tend to agree with Mr. Breeden. I mean, what was presented in the hearing outside the presence of the jury seemed to be more than I saw in most trials I presided over in terms of people coming in to office personnel, the CFO of the hospital system to say these are reasonable and customary charges for the procedures that were performed. Then I agree an expert needs to say the procedures that were performed had to be performed because of the subsequent, you know, procedures were necessary because of the negligence. But the court, I don't think the court was drawing the distinction that you just mentioned. She was just saying you need some expert to come in that's kind of can talk about reasonable and customariness.
Well, Your Honor, I do think there was briefing to the trial court on this issue. And in the briefs that the defense presented, we did argue, I think I said Cook earlier, but it was Banks versus Sunrise Hospital, that decision says that you have to have an expert to testify that the care is related to the negligence. So whether or not the trial court judge specifically articulated that as the basis for her decision, that was certainly briefed to the trial court and argued by the defense. And the evidence that the plaintiff wanted to present was office staff people who were not clinicians and were not able to offer that specific opinion, nor were they ever designated to offer such an opinion as discovery proceeded. So I do think it was appropriate for the trial court to exclude the damages in this case. And, you know, even if the court feels that the evidence the plaintiff wanted to present was sufficient, that again goes to damages, and this case really turned on liability. And since the jury never reached that issue, I think that would be something for the court to consider. With that, I will conclude that the jury verdict was supported by substantial evidence. Any alleged errors from the plaintiff were harmless or non-existent. And with that, if the court has no questions for me, any questions?
Anything further, Chief?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hall.
I'd like to begin where Ms. Hall concluded, which is this issue of the billing, because, two concepts are conflated here, and they were conflated at trial and mixed together, and they're completely separate. The issue of whether the treatment after the perforation is reasonable and necessary and causally related to the perforation, that is a medical issue that there must be competent medical expert testimony on. We had that. Dr. Burke was our expert, and he testified to all that. What we're talking about is something separate, which is this billing issue, because you have to also establish that the amount of the billing is usual, customary, and reasonable. Now, some people just say reasonable as a shortcut. Some people say UCR amounts for usual, customary, and reasonable. But that was the issue there. And again, our position is, as many states have adopted, look, if the defense does not contest it, the bill itself and the fact that it was paid is prima facie evidence that it was usual, customary, and reasonable. The defense didn't even contest this stuff. By the way, they didn't even contest the reasonableness and necessity of the aftercare either. These were not issues. The only medical thing they contested was the standard of care. They admitted to all the damage or did not contest it. Moving back to the issue of informed consent, I want to frankly tell the court that I think there's a problem with the Busick versus Trainer case because it does not contain much analysis. And it acknowledges that a patient can't consent to negligence, but then it doesn't really explain how the evidence was used in that case, and the case was not overturned on appeal. So it kind of floats around in these circles as a case that says, yeah, a patient can't consent to negligence, but you can still introduce all this evidence, and the Nevada Supreme Court doesn't reverse. And so I really think we need an opinion with a lot more detail and explanation about this issue. I think it's also telling because I heard Ms. Hall say, no, our defense at trial was this was a unavoidable risk or an unavoidable accident. That's not what was presented at trial at all. And I made sure every medical expert that testified, our expert, the defendant, and the defense expert testified that you could certainly safely perform this procedure on the woman. These perforations do not, spontaneously appear, and that this was done with the instrument controlled by the doctor.
What about the argument that because of her particular anatomy, this was unavoidable?
So everyone who has this procedure has unusual anatomy. And the evidence was that 1 in 5 women, for example, have a retroverted uterus. This is not highly abnormal. But if it was so abnormal that the procedure couldn't be safely done, the procedure shouldn't have been attempted. And the defendant admitted, I knew of all these medical conditions before I operated. I felt I could safely operate it, but I caused these perforations. And with that, I see my time is concluded. So I'll say.
All right. Counsel, thank you.